This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Once again, we're here for another episode of the Beyond Broadcast podcast, the show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with journalist and producer Charlie Drever. Originally from Crawley in the UK, Charlie has been in the news cycle trenches following the biggest stories in New Zealand and further afield. However, more recently, she's made a return to the motherland, is now based in London with her husband. It's worth mentioning that outside of the newsroom, she's dabbled in football, roller derby, and travelling. It is such a pleasure to have her with me today. Welcome to the show, Charlie. How are you doing, mate?
Kia ora, thanks so much for having me. I'm great, thank you, here in London where it's absolutely freezing.
And we're on like polar opposite sides of the world because I'm in Argentina. We were just chatting before about the fact that it's 34 degrees here. I don't know how cold it is where you are, but I'm guessing it's absolutely freezing.
Yeah, it's like single digits, but also I think the main thing is that I haven't really seen the sun in about 3 weeks. So that's kind of the main thing that's tough at the moment. But I'm looking forward to having my Europe summer in a few months, so that would be good.
Oh, 100%. And you're probably doing the whole classic London working hours as well. I don't know if you had a similar experience to myself, but I was getting up at Sparrows Farm, 6 o'clock in the morning, wasn't even seeing the sunlight, and then coming out of the office at maybe 6, 7 o'clock at night. So the only like ray of sunshine was getting out of the tube station. Or have you managed to avoid that sort of kind of working schedule?
Well, I'm doing like an 8 to 5, and that's been okay. But like you said, you like don't see the sun and you're just underground. And I've realized like a lot of London, I'll turn up to places like, oh, I stopped here on the tube because I've just been that underground. Of like hours at a time. I worked out 1 week, I must have been underground for about 11 hours that week, and it's just, yeah, it's I'm just a little mole person in London commuting back and forth, but it's been good, but yeah, long hours, really dark, and yeah, I just really need some sun.
You know it's bad when the respite is catching the train just so you can see a little bit of, not the train, the bus, just so you can see a little bit of scenery. I kind of feel you on that one. It's definitely a big pivot from New Zealand, which, like, how long ago did you end up moving to London?
So we moved back in July. So, you know, gorgeous weather and going from, in New Zealand, we walked like 15 minutes to the office. And then came here and it's summer and like, this is so great. This is amazing. Getting less and less like that now, but you know, we're at the tail end of it. So we've only been here less than a year. So it's been a big culture shift, but we're enjoying it so far.
That's brilliant. So Charlie, we'll kick things off and going like rewinding massively back to like the early days of Charlie Drever, where she was at, what she was doing. And if we're talking about rewinding, we're rewinding back to the UK, basically. So this is kind of like a return to force of you being back at home in a way. But you grew up in Crawley. So I'm trying to think of the fact that, like, you would have been what? How old were you when you finally left the UK?
I was only 11. So it's it's kind of weird because people ask me, like, they hear my accent and they're like, oh, you Kiwi. And like, I'm technically British, but culturally Kiwi because I've lived in New Zealand for 20 years. But I grew up, yeah, in Crawley of all places, which for people who aren't familiar where Crawley is, it's directly between London and Brighton. It's kind of like this small town that's near Gatwick Airport. Most people work at the airport there. And yeah, it's I feel like I'm kind of in the big city now that I'm in London, because it was kind of this big, cool place that people got to work at that. It's been really nice making that shift and actually being in London at the center of it rather than like it being a day trip that you got to go to in the school holidays.
So like the day trip and the school holidays, you would have also had that with Brighton Pier as well. Was there any favorite like fear game at the pier that you like to, that you remember from those days back in the day? Like the penny slots or anything like that?
I was just about to say the penny slots, the 2p machines. Like,
oh, yeah,
we'd
nice.
Like, I'd like save up a bag of 2p's and take them down there. And so, because there's a game show now, I'm trying to think of the name of it. There's a game show that's like based off of that. And I was like, that would be mean to do because I used to like just love sitting there with my little 2p's. I'd get like a pound. And that was what I really enjoyed doing. I never went away with anything and it would just be like 2p's, but I really enjoyed that. But probably I enjoyed London the most though, because I used to love going to the museums. And that was like my nerdy little thing to do, is that I used to drag my mum around 3 or 4 museums in a day, which I try to do now, like a few weeks ago, and it's exhausting after 2. So I don't know, my poor mum.
Your poor mum was dragged around.
Yeah. So, yeah, I appreciate that a lot more now that I try to do it as an adult, and it was, yeah, absolutely exhausting.
And I guess another controversial question that we could go down as well, because there's 2 Brightons. There's Brighton in New Zealand in Christchurch, and there's Brighton, obviously, where you're originally from, or around the corner from where you're from. Which has the better fish and chips, Brighton in the UK or Brighton in Christchurch?
Ooh,
and you obviously don't eat them because you're vegan, aren't you?
I'm vegetarian.
Vegetarian.
Yes, I was vegan for 10 years, but I went vegetarian before going to Europe because I thought it was going to be too hard. But the chips, I've got to say, New Zealand, I'm going to revoke my passport here, but I really don't like the chips here. I really like the New Zealand chips. The chips and the coffee, the chips and the coffee is what I really miss. Like, you'll know the coffee here isn't great. I've specifically found New Zealand and Australian owned cafes so that I can get a decent coffee. And I still haven't found a good chip place yet, unfortunately.
You're definitely making me feel a lot better, because I felt like, am I being that classic Kiwi that goes on to the other side of the world to try and find familiarity in something? Like, oh, I'll go to New Zealand-only pubs. I'll go meet up with New Zealanders to go hang out every now and then. I don't know. Do you feel like that's kind of happening with you, but you're having this like reverse culture thing? Because obviously you're originally from the UK, but
yeah,
you're identifying now more with New Zealand culture more and more, I'm guessing.
I am. I didn't realize how much of a shift that culturally I am very Kiwi. And even my family, when like my in-laws back in New Zealand, they heard me on podcast here and they're like, we always thought you were British, but now we've actually heard you next to other people, we're realizing that you're actually Kiwi. So yeah, it's kind of interesting, because I thought it'd be kind of my coming home moment that I'm like, oh, finally I fit in, and it just all feels right. But now I'm Kiwi, and I live with all Kiwis as well. So, you know, it's kind of reinforcing that for me. Every time one of us, whenever I like hang out with a British person, I'm like, guys, I hung out with like a local today. It's
like, I found a live one, finally. And we'll talk about like other non-traditional things that have kind of happened in your life, because as I said, it's interesting to see someone that's originally from the UK, moves to New Zealand, has this transition to basically feeling more Kiwi than British. And in another sense as well, you've had some pretty non-traditional sort of education as well. For anyone who doesn't know, like I said, Charlie ended up shifting over to New Zealand and actually shifting to Christchurch of all places. And in that sort of period as well, you ended up going to a pretty non-traditional school. I can't remember the name of the actual education system itself, but the name of the school is Unlimited. And How would you describe the way that Unlimited kind of teaches kids or how they manage students? How would you describe that?
Well, it's known as a special character school. So it's like a public school, but it has its own, it has its own ethos. It's not traditional in the sense that I'd like to tell people that I went to a weird hippy dippy school is kind of like the way I open it. But I went to a normal school for a year, and I did really badly in it. Actually, I really struggled. I was skiving off of school quite a bit. I was getting quite a lot of trouble. I was getting in fights. It wasn't good. I was really struggling to adjust. Moving to New Zealand. I wasn't really happy, and I was kind of acting out a bit. And so my parents kind of looked at some options for me. I'd gone to, for people who aren't familiar, decile systems, which I think they've got rid of now in New Zealand. But back then it was like a decile one, which is like the poorest of the poorest school. And so when my family was trying to find me other places to go, people would see what school I was at and didn't want to accept me. My parents, you know, I grew up very working class, could not afford private school either. So that wasn't an option. But there was a School Unlimited that was taking people in, and they don't have teachers. They had learning advisors. You could change your classes every 6 weeks. And it was really good for me because I had like a fairly decent sense of what I wanted to do when I grew up. So even as like a little kid, I used to make my own radio shows, which is embarrassing, but I did. And then like, I had my own magazine. I had my own magazine that I would write myself. So I was fairly certain I wanted to do either something in drama, actually, or journalism. So when I went to Unlimited, I could really focus on that. So I could do English really. Like I could sit my year 11 and 12 exams early. I didn't like maths, so I put that off, which I now regret, because I found out that there's actually quite a lot of math involved in journalism. So I've had to like teach myself after school because I had like the lowest level you needed for university entrance. And I was like, well, there's a lot of stats involved in journalism. I hadn't really thought that through. But the school was great because, I really got to focus on my passions, and I did work experience at a local, it's called CTV, a local television station, did a couple of weeks of them. So they really encouraged you to follow your passions. And I don't think it necessarily works for everyone, but I think if you have like a kind of good sense of what you want to do and some level of motivation, it's actually really good. And it was a really great school, and it really cemented me wanting to be a journalist, especially as you know, you're in Christchurch as well during the earthquakes. My school, Unlimited Paying a Tufty, was destroyed, and we had to move out to the middle of nowhere to this like only boys school, which had behavioral issues, and they were actually took exception to our school for not being very respectful, which was a bit of a burn. Like these kids who are supposed to have behavioral issues, and they're like, yeah, they're really disrespectful of our school. And it was like, oh gosh. But there were some characters at my school, so I'm not too surprised about that. But like after the earthquakes and seeing all the news coverage, and then getting to work at CTV, which their building was destroyed, a lot of people lost their lives, and then working with them, I was just like, yeah, this is what I want to do. So I applied for broadcasting school, which is where I met yourself and my now husband as well. So, you know, it all worked out.
it's interesting because a lot of the people I've spoken to in the past about how they got their start in media or how they ended up getting into whether it be journalism, radio, whatever, there was never this realization so early on. I think you're one of the first people I've spoken to, especially for this podcast, who's had just this idea from the get-go. Was this something that you feel was influenced by, as you said, a little bit of your environment? Do you think there was a little bit of your parents as well?
Because I can't imagine
your peers would have been equally in that same vibe. I know Unlimited obviously has this sort of like different style of learning, but do you feel there was a lot of your peers that were very similar to you in that way, or not really?
No, to be honest, like my parents, we can't like, what was that? We don't know where it came from. Because, like, I grew up from, like, you know, very working class. My dad was a plumber. My mum worked in call centers and the supermarkets. I didn't know any journalists. The only time I'd met a journalist was actually when I'd won this competition for the Queen's Golden Jubilee to draw a picture of the Queen. And it ended up looking like this puppet from the show, from this show. So everyone thought it was really funny and that I was trying to emulate this puppet, but I was actually just really bad at drawing. But I ended up winning the whole competition and they did a newspaper article about me. And then they had like letters to the editors and people were writing about it. And so I was really like, oh, this is quite cool. And from that point, I started, you know, reading the newspaper and got into news. So I didn't know anyone who was a journalist. Didn't know anyone in the media. And whereas, like, I know a lot of people that, like, their family or they have friends or someone in the media, but I didn't have that. And I'm not entirely sure why all of a sudden I had this fixation on journalism. And I used to just watch the BBC news when I was homesick. Like, I really used to enjoy just watching the news. And so, yeah, I just stuck with it, really.
Do you think, in a way, because I have found that a lot of people that have entered media have pre-existing connections. It's almost, and I don't mean it in a mean way, I think it's just the real.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Quality of the industry, in a way, that there is a little bit of nepotism in the way that people have connections to either journalists, television executives, or whatever the such. Like, I definitely noticed it, especially when I moved to the UK, when I was asking people, like, so, like, how did you get in here? Oh, my dad's such and such. He has a connection to here. Do you feel, in a way, that almost motivated your career even further because you knew, like, I don't have these pre-existing connections. I have to make it for myself. Is that where the kind of making your own radio shows and, like, doing your own little magazine thing, do you feel like that's where it came from? Because you're like, I need to make my own opportunities or need to make my own chances?
I think back then it was because I just enjoyed it. And, you know, my parents always said, you could be anything you want to be. So in my head, I was like, I can be anything I want to be. And then I think when I got to broadcasting school, some of the people were from, like, the top schools in New Zealand, and I felt very inadequate very quickly. And I realized that I probably needed to work really hard because there's just certain things that I realized that I hadn't had, like, as good of an education. I don't have the connections. And I probably had a bit of a chip on my shoulder, if I'm honest with myself. Like, I think back to myself early on, and I had this kind of, I don't want to say arrogance, but, like, I think I was trying to overcompensate on the fact that I didn't feel completely comfortable around everyone else. I thought, like, I had major imposter syndrome. Like, I was like, they're going to find out I'm stupid and I don't know what I'm doing. So pretty early on, I was like, I'm just going to work harder than everybody else and just graft. Like, that was something my dad always used to say to me, is like, you're like, we're grafters. So I kind of just was like, okay, I might not be the most talented. I might not have the best education. I might not have the best connections, but I can work really hard. And so I just applied that to everything I did. And I found that I went in thinking I'd maybe do documentaries. And then we did a week in a radio newsroom environment, and I actually surprisingly did well at that. and really enjoyed it. So I took an early internship and went from there, really. But I definitely didn't have maybe the traditional entry into media that a lot of people have.
I don't think that's a totally, how would you say, I'm sure there were other people that probably had a similar feeling to you. I certainly know for myself, it was exactly the same. I didn't come from a media background as well. Both of my parents are very working class. We had zero connections to radio or anything. Yeah. It was more like, oh, Jamie, that's nice that you're going to try and do that. Let's see, like, if you can actually make it happen. And if it happens, awesome. But, like, I was the same to you. No maths. I went to some non-traditional, like, country school in Christchurch. Mm. So I fully relate to you. And, yeah, I think it comes down to that whole feeling of, like, yeah, if I graft hard enough, I can get through there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could totally understand. The exact same feeling as you of the, because I did a little bit of radio before going to broadcasting school. And I was like, oh, these guys haven't even fucking worked at a station. Like, I've done that. I know exactly how to do it. I'm going to be the next radio host. And got there on the first day. And I was like, oh, shit, all these guys are 10 times better than me. They're far more interesting. They're far more animated. Like, oh, God, I'm totally fucked here. Like, what am I going to do? So I completely relate to you on that front. And I think it's interesting you talk about how you're basically like, I need to work hard at this and then it will come to me. And it has, like, everything has come to you because of the fact that you grafted so hard. And if we're moving through broadcasting school as well, I will ask one other question related to broadcasting school, because I do want to move past that quite quickly, because your career has been incredibly interesting. What do you think is something that you learned at broadcasting school that has still stuck with you today? We had a lot of interesting lectures that covered a lot of variety of different topics and other things like that. Is there any particular learning moment that you had from university that you still stick by today, whether that be from a journalist perspective or just maybe broadcasting history perspective? What do you think is something you still live by today or acknowledge today?
I think a big thing is working with people in different, like, we had our streams, you know, like the journalism stream, the radio stream, the TV stream, and we had this semester was like called, was it 600 or 700, something like that, where we had a semester where we worked together and did projects together. That really stuck with me because you worked with different people who wanted different things, different personalities, and it was a really good experience making something practical with different personalities and different talents. And I think that was really good before going into the workplace, because you're working with people on different streams, and there was like big personalities, especially in radio. There was some personalities. No, it was great though. And, you know, there's really talented people in TV. And I think that's one of the things I took away from it. And also just that you can do lots of different things, because I had a very narrow idea of what you could do with journalism, and over the years it's changed so much, but I felt like broadcasting school really set me up well for that, to be able to adapt, and also the long hours as well. I remember doing like a 60-hour week at broadcasting school, and I remember a rumor about someone sleeping there overnight, like snuck in and slept in overnight. There was so many long hours. I think at one moment I was like close to breaking point, because I was like, I'm actually going insane. I haven't slept properly in days because I had to get this project done. So I think that kind of stuff set me up really well. And like, there's people that I still talk to for a connection to that I went to broadcasting school with. And it's kind of like this shared experience. So maybe that, I probably should say something more like, oh, this thing happened. Actually, treated the Marae visit, actually, going to Marae was the first time I went to a Marae. And that was an awesome experience. And then my first internship was working up in Whangarei, and I did a lot of work at Marae, so that I took that away from me, actually. So, yeah.
No answer is a terrible answer. I think that's actually interesting that you touch on the whole cross-stream sort of work that we did, because it's kind of indicative of how you are now, because the thing is, media has changed so much over the last few years that everything is kind of blending together. I certainly know when I did radio, there was this whole very, how would you say, traditionalist view of, I think online media was starting to come in, like, but we still weren't learning about it that much. Everyone's like, oh yeah, you could do podcasts, but no, this is radio only. You're only going to do radio. And now everything is blending together, video, radio, podcasting, journalism is blending into radio and also into podcasting. It's like everything is one now, and the expectations for someone is to be multi-skilled. So I think what you're touching on is massively important because, yeah, everything is kind of getting to a point that you have to work with different personalities, you have to have different knowledge. So I don't think that's a bad answer. If anything, it's probably the most accurate answer, especially for now. And so you had this internship in Whangarei, and then on top of that, you moved pretty quickly into what I would consider a pretty major role. You became the lead producer for what I would probably call one of the most recognized faces and voices in talkback radio, Mike Hosking. So I'm curious, is the man on air very different from the man that you meet in person? Because talkback is a very character-based sort of medium. I know this from having worked in talkback that maybe someone will have more extreme views on air compared to what they have in real person. So I guess the first question being, what was it like working with Mike Hosking behind the mic and after off air?
Oh, I was a setup producer. I had a very good lead producer as well. But I was a setup producer, and that was my, at 21, which was pretty full on. And it was only me who did the setup shift. And it was actually pretty, it was full on. And I probably only spoke to Mike a handful of times because it was my job to get there at 3 p.m., set up 6 interviews, write up some notes, and then go home. Sometimes at like, I think there was one time that there was actually crossover when he got in around 3 a.m. and I was still frantically trying to do the notes. I remember I burst a blood vessel in my eye because I was so and the first interview for the morning, I still remember this, the first interview for the morning cancelled. And so I ended up, it was about diamond prices or something. And they were all at this like this convention or something. So that's why I couldn't get hold of any of these people to talk about diamonds. And I ended up getting like this diamond mine owner or something in South Africa at like 11 p.m. at night. But at this point, I'd been frantically calling. So I had all these notes to write up, and he comes in at 3 a.m. and I'm just like, I hate to think what I look like. I walked home and I had a burst blood vessel. I had like streaky makeup where I'd been like literally like, people won't be able to see this, but just like rubbing my like eyes because I was like so stressed and like trying not to cry because I'd only been in the job for like 2 weeks. I was like, I got to prove that I can do this because they like mentioned in the interview about how young I was. And so I was like determined to be like, I can do this. But yeah, Mike was an interesting guy. He's a hard worker. He's a hard worker. We probably had different, he probably doesn't even remember me, to be honest, because he had so many producers. But yeah, he's an interesting guy. From the few times I spoke to him, he has a high standard and he works very hard. And that's all I can say about that. But yeah. And he's good at what he does because he's, you know, that was 10 years ago and he's still at the top of his game. So, you know, give him that.
I think we can build off what you were just talking about there, because I think that's one thing that maybe people don't realize about talkback radio, how much preparation goes into it. As you said,
yeah,
for even just a 3-hour slot, you can be spending hours and hours on end setting up. And also it's the timeliness of it. You're not doing this a week in advance. These are stories that are like going to be still relevant tomorrow, but you need to get a hold of guests the day before almost.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like for any journalist that truly wants to appreciate putting together a show, do you feel like they need to do a stint and talk back to understand like the difficulty of like producing a show?
I maybe not talk back, but definitely like a breakfast show, a morning show, because you have to think a certain way with how, because you got to work out what the big stories for the morning are going to be, and you got to find a way to bring it forward because there could be a massive story the day before, but it's old by the morning. So you're like, well, it's still going to be a massive story, but I've got to find a new way to tell it. Which is actually a really important skill as a journalist to have, because you can have this big scoop and then you still have to keep the story going. So you got to always be like, what's my next angle going to be? There's this time pressure and it's just like there's a lot of begging. I got the nickname Charming Charlie because I used to put on this kind of this. I didn't realize I was doing it like a phone voice, but it was like an octave higher than my normal voice, being like, so especially if we had to get people in Australia, and like the first slot I had to book was like 6:40, so that's 4:40 a.m. for people in Australia who probably have never heard of this show in New Zealand. And so you just feel like, oh, are you sure it's okay to get up that early? Oh, thank you so much. And, you know, like, I didn't realize I was doing it. And someone's like, got someone up at, yeah, I think they were like Perth or something. So it was like an ungodly hour. And someone's like, oh, Charming Charlie's done it again. I was like, that's so... So I wore that as like a badge of honor that I could get people off at like obscene times. But I think a lot of journalists should do it. A lot of producers should do it because you have that time pressure and yeah, you have to really think ahead, which I think sometimes it can be hard to do. So yeah.
What do you think was a skill that you took away from that? Because that's essentially, you're basically doing sales, you're cold calling. So obviously... raising the inflection by a couple of semitones to kind of come across a bit more approachable. What was your classic go-to line to kind of get past maybe someone's inhibitions to kind of come on? What would you say was your classic go-to phrasing of being like, this will be a really good opportunity for you to promote your work, or like, what was kind of your go-to?
I'm giving away my secrets now. Being like, I don't want to sound disingenuous, but you know, like, because people are going to hear this now, next time I ask them to do an interview, they're like, oh, just give me a line. But I'd always just say about how excited we are and that we saw the story and like, oh, that'd be such a great thing to talk about. And it'd be so interesting for our audience, like kind of just stuff like that. I'd mix it up because sometimes you have to go back to them and you don't want to say the same lines again. But, you know, like saying along those lines that how excited you are, showing a lot of interest. And I'm like, oh, just let me write this down. And I would actually be writing it down, but I feel like it's worth like knowing that. So they're like, oh, what I'm saying is important. And then you'll be like, oh, and by the way, the interview is at the start. You know, that was kind of, you know, like really me.
Like the terms and conditions of a contract. Let's slide that in. Yeah.
Well, you gotta get up really early and then you got to do this. So yeah, so I'd kind of show my interest, show that I'd like do some research beforehand so that you're not going in and being like, so tell me about this, that you like, you go in there kind of knowing what you want and then you do the sales pitch and then you tell them what horrible hour they have to get up at. So yeah, that was kind of the way I'd go about it.
What do you think was the wildest pivot you've had to make during your show? For example, I've been on I worked in talkback for a bit, I worked in sports radio as well, which anything can happen in sports radio, especially with crazy footballers, which is mostly what I was doing. But the craziest pivot I've ever seen was a friend of mine who actually had to pivot when the Queen died. What would you...
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Say... was the wildest pivot you've had to make on a fully produced show? What was maybe the most memorable story that you had to be like, we have to get rid of everything and go straight to this? Is there one that sticks out for you?
There's one that immediately goes to my mind. So this wasn't when I was working in Talkback, because I worked at RNZ, public broadcaster in New Zealand, for 7 years. And I worked on a few shows, but one of them was The Panel with Wallace Chapman. And I'd booked 7 interviews and I was writing up the notes and it was going well. And then Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern resigns. And about an hour and a half, I want to say, before the show goes to air, I had to scrap everything and redo the show. And it was just me and the host, just us two that works on the show. And I booked 9 guests in that hour and a half and wrote... I was sweaty afterwards, like as having the, like I distinctly feel like I was like actually sweaty and gross because I was so stressed. And like I had a great, like, Willis is lovely. So that really helped. And I had a really good studio up with me and we put the show to air, but it was absolutely manic. And it was, 9 interviews. And I remember the person in charge, they were like undecided on one of the interviews I wanted to do, one of the executive producers higher up. And I was like, being like, no, this is important. I was like, also, we don't have time for this. Just need to get this done. Just, And it all worked out well. But it was, an hour and a half to book a completely new show and have extra interviews than I already had. It was just like manic. Or I think another one is, actually, you said the Queen dying. I woke up to the Queen dying and it was all of the regular programming was scrapped. And it was really cool. This the same producer asked me to do like an 8-minute obit package where I just got to go wild Very for nice. 8 minutes and do whatever I wanted. And I had 2 hours to do it. And so usually you'd work on a package that's like 3 or 4 minutes throughout the day with a little bit of news sprinkled in, but no, it was 2 hours to an 8-minute package. And that was hectic. And people were like listening back to it to sub it in like speed, cause we didn't have enough time to listen to the package before it went to air. Like you just had to like play it very quickly, and be like, yep, that's good. Pop it on air. And so, but those are my favorite days. Like that's wild, but you're so stressed, but those are probably like my favorite days that I've ever worked. I don't know what that says about me as a person, but yeah.
Because it's interesting, because I also saw in your CV that it seems like you took a bit of a sabbatical at one point to kind of go back to Christchurch, and you worked for St. John. So I'm kind of wondering, do you like just being in stressful situations? Because you're basically doing a phone call operating role, right, for a little bit. Like, do you feel journalism in a way kind of helped you in that like little sabbatical role that you took with St. John? Because this is the thing, you're talking to people that are in their most stressful situations imaginable, and you're having to keep them calm. Meanwhile, you've been in the throes and the trenches of a newsroom. Do you think that kind of helped you out in that sense?
Oh, 100%. I think, it really helped, because I had a kind of, this is an embarrassing term, but quarter life crisis, where I wasn't super happy in commercial. There was kind of an upheaval in the newsroom where like loads of people moved and it was a very stressful environment, just because it was like short staffing, the pay was really bad. And so I was like, oh, do I want to keep doing this? But I was like, I need something that will like fulfill me. I feel like I need to do something that I feel like is making a difference. And I felt like I wasn't getting that from journalism at that point in time. And so I was like, what can I do? And I liked covering emergency services stories. So I looked at being a police officer, actually, but I'm too blind to be a police officer because there was a certain amount of vision you needed. And I don't have it. And so I was like, oh, okay, I could get laser eye, but then you have to wait. Anyway, it was a long wait. And I was like, I can't do that. So I looked at being an emergency call handler. And there is like this very much call under pressure type environment. Having a nice clear voice helps, actually. And I'd try and have a very soothing voice to people. So, cause you want to try and calm them down, especially in like stressful situations, which I dealt with a lot of. I really take my hat off to people who can do that job for a really long time. I know there is quite a lot of quick turnaround because it is such a stressful job. And I thought I was dealing with a lot of doom and gloom in journalism because you're always covering like these big stories and terrible things happening, but then you're literally getting 60, 70 calls like that every day. So I really, and also there'd be a really like major thing. And I'm like, surely a news agency will pick up on this. And I'd like check the sites. And I'm like, this is such a big story. And then I was just like, obviously I would never, because you'd never share those, but you'd be like, man, someone should really be reporting on this. And then I was just like, realized that I was like, oh, maybe I should give journalism another crack and I'm in the wrong place. I was like, oh, I'll always go what if. So I tried to get a new job and I did it Radio New Zealand, thinking I'd be there for a couple of years, maybe go overseas. And then 7 years on, I was there. That's the trap of Radio New Zealand, is you go for like, you think you're going to go in for just a little bit, but then you end up staying a really long time. So
Do you think that realization was important though for you? Do you feel like if you just continued in commercial radio, kept on like going with the ebbs and flows, that maybe you wouldn't be where you are today? Do you feel it was important to have that moment, that kind of realization of being like, I need to reset myself and go back in to know that I really want this?
Yeah, I think so as well, that it helped me appreciate it more and also just have a bit of life experience, because I'd gone straight from, I had one gap year between high school and starting broadcasting school. And then I was in my 20s doing these jobs, and I was working commercial radio. And it's like a lot more quick turnaround and less long form stuff. And I kind of wanted something different out of it. And I was just feeling a bit disenfranchised, where I felt like taking a break, I got to appreciate it and also just have that life experience, which I think really helped me going forward. And I also did a lot of stories around emergency services as well. So it gave me some story ideas, which I wasn't meaning to do, but it kind of worked. It kind of panned out that way.
Sort of like a method actor. You're inserting yourself in the situation to better understand it. Yeah. I love
that. Well, some people didn't initially trust me when I started because they thought I was like media trying to get an insight.
They thought you were like the insider.
Yeah. I was like, I'm not like that. And then I left and then immediately went back to media. And I was like, oh, I swear that wasn't my intention.
I didn't mean to, guys. Yeah. Trust me. I'm good at teachers. And we were talking off air a little bit about this because you're working for the national broadcast. And now when I met you, Charlie, you had a pretty significantly strong British accent. So now you're working for the equivalent of the BBC in New Zealand. So how long did it take for them to hammer into you a sort of Kiwi traditional broadcasting accent?
Well, it started at broadcasting school because there was a bulletin that I said bothered. And then I came up and they were laughing. And they're like, we should have known not to put bothered in the script. And so I spoke to people at broadcasting school and they're like, we're going to have to iron out your accent. So bless him, my husband now, when we'd first started dating, it was his role to correct me when I had a glottal stop. And it really caused a lot of tension in our relationship early on. So I'd be telling a story and be like, you miss your tea again, or you've said, like, for example, 33, I'd say it's 33. And so obviously it wasn't accepted as a broadcasting voice. It was kind of Cockney, and that wasn't the standard. So I kind of, it slowly developed that my accent got more and more Kiwi. I think as well, like, it really helped that RNZ was really big on teaching Te Reo Māori lessons, which I felt really helped as well, sounding Kiwi on air. And also it's just important to be able to pronounce place name properly, people's names properly, and, you know, acknowledge the treaty. So I think that helped. But yeah, it was a work in progress, I think, and having a bit of voice training and just doing some homework in my own time, and especially just trying in my day-to-day life sound more Kiwi, because you can't just, I don't know, unless you're like an actor that can like switch between accents, which I can't, because I wouldn't make myself sound like this if I could choose my accent. You kind of just had to do the little steps at home and try and make your accent sound more Kiwi. But I still got text messages from people being like, is she a pom trying to sound Kiwi, or is she a Kiwi trying to sound like a pom? I actually had someone who used to call me Dreadful Dreever because he hated my accent. I'm assuming a he. It could be a she. I shouldn't assume, because they hated my accent so much. So, you know, it was a work in progress. I haven't quite perfected it. But people tend to recognize my voice. Like, it got recognized. And they're like, oh, you're Charlie from RNZ. I recognize the accent. So I try and see it that way, that it makes me a bit more distinctive.
Because you also did a story on Vocal Fry, I noticed, a while back. You did a story on Vocal Fry, and I'd be really intrigued to know, do you feel like your standards have like been kind of like upped based on the fact that you've worked for RNZ? Because I know RNZ in the past, back in the 80s, weirdly, for anyone that knows anything about New Zealand, obviously we're a Commonwealth country. And back in the 80s, in radio, journalism, everything else, there was almost an expectation that we had to sound more English. We had to have these sorts of like various sounds to our voice. Now it's total opposite. Do you feel like your standards in terms of what you expect from your voice or when you're listening to radio has got a lot higher, especially with things like Vocal Fry, or no?
I think so. I think a big thing for me is people putting on a voice. Like, but then there's a certain element of that, because you want to sound clear and have good diction. But I found myself falling into the trap that when I got a job at RNZ, I was like, man, this is like, prestigious place to work, so I need to sound prestigious. And I remember actually John Campbell, when he worked at Armitage, rang me up. He's like, Charlie, I don't think that's your voice. And he called me out on it. He's like, I bet you don't sound like that. So can you stop like sounding like that? Just be yourself. And I was like, okay. And I tried to take that on board. And and I think my normal day-to-day voice has actually got more diction and clearer now, just because I'm trying not to swap between the two voices. And that kind of like when your mum has a phone voice, it's a bit, you don't want to sound too much like that. So I've been trying, and I do have a vocal fry sometimes as well. So I don't know. I remember doing a vocal fry in that story actually, and someone texted in being like, she's talking about a vocal fry and then she's doing it herself. And I did it at the end of the joke and I was like, okay, joke was kind of lost on you. That's fine. But yeah, I do notice that when people, I hear them in real life and then all of a sudden they sound like this on air. And I'm like, you don't sound like that. Just sound like yourself. But I get it because I did exactly the same thing. So
I feel like it's almost ridiculous to hear that from John Campbell because he sounds like he's putting on his voice. But obviously,
but he sounds like that in real life.
It's his natural voice. It's scary. It doesn't sound real.
That's his real voice. So yeah, he sounds exactly like that. So if you hear anyone with this big, like booming, like broadcasting voice, that is actually what they sound like. So yeah, that's him. I know, I felt the same. And then I was like, oh, wow, no, you that's you 100% of the time. And that's actually a really, yeah, just be yourself on air. And I think it resonates with people better as well when they know you're not putting on airs and it makes you more approachable. So,
oh, 100%. Yeah. It kind of reminds me of a voice actor / famous actor from the UK. People might know him from Blackadder, but when I was working in London, he used to come in and do voice work for, I think, like ADR and ads. His name's Brian Blessed. Most people know him as the actor who hand-fought a bear-fisted and climbed Mount Everest. He looks like what he sounds like. He's a big Scotsman with a big beard. And I thought his voice was fake, but it's actually 100% true. Even when he walked into the room, he had this ridiculous bear-like voice that sounded like a king was like announcing a message to the townspeople. So yeah, it is interesting to see that, like, despite everyone thinking it, sometimes your natural voice is the best voice. And I certainly know for myself, I've had people tell me that as well and be like, you're putting on a radio voice. It sounds fake. Stop it. You sound like a dick. So I'm glad that you kind of had that voice as well.
Yeah, it's nice. I also sounded like a dick, yeah. So that's, yeah. But, you know, it's easy to slip into it, and I still do it sometimes as well. I'm trying to sound more conversation now. I've moved into podcasting, and I slip back into my bulletin kind of reading voice, and I'm trying to snap out of it, but it's easily done.
And we talked about well, you mentioned commercial radio. It's all very short, very concise, to the point, rapid, needs to be all released. So you had this change of pace by going to RNZ where they give you a bit more time. There's a lot more focus on going deeper into the story and making sure you're telling a narrative that isn't just cut straight to the point. And interestingly, you got to insert yourself into the story, which is RNZ gave you the chance to put together like a series on endometriosis. I'm just curious, how did that all come about? Because that for a...
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
A lot of women must have been a pretty interesting thing to see. One, the national broadcaster doing a special on endometriosis, and two, you be able to explore it yourself and people to follow you on that journey as well. So how did that all come about?
Well, in the story itself, it kind of opens up at the point that I decided to do a story on this. I was on holiday, and it always sounds very like silly when I was crying about turning 29, and that I know that would make me, oh god, get a grip. But the reason why I was crying was because I'd been told to have a child by 30, or at least be trying by the age of 30, and I just did not feel ready at all. And especially in broadcasting, I feel like I was really sort of feeling like I was making progression in my career, and I kind of was just like this overwhelming feeling of like not knowing what to do about it and doing research myself. I was seeing a lot of people struggling to get diagnosis and then having like the fertility issues, but I hadn't really seen anything on that whole decision making, because it's like a huge decision when you're going to have kids and you have this whole extra thing that you have to deal with, and really weighs on your decision making. So I kind of had this idea, you know, like, oh, what if I talk about it and I interview people and it informs my decision making. I was really lucky that I got in talking to John, he's like the head of long forms at RNZ. And I was like, oh, I kind of had this idea. And he was like, yeah, 100%. And so they let me roll with it. And the biggest thing was actually just getting time away from my normal job, because usually you get maybe like a bit longer than I got. I had a month to get this done. So it was like a lot of work, and at times juggling my actual like normal job with this, but I was really passionate about it. And yeah, I just kind of drove me to want to do, just raise awareness to it. And I knew so many people in similar situations, so it was actually not difficult at all to find talent. If anything, I had too many people, which is really great, because I remember as a teenager, all that kind of stuff felt really taboo. And so it was really nice having like these raw conversations. People really wanted to get behind it. And I felt very protective of some of the people that were speaking to me, like women who were really done wrong by the medical, well, just done wrong by the doctors, basically just fobbed off, which I had dealt with a lot of as well, and making sure that their stories were, because I don't usually like to share my copy with people I'm writing about, but I really try to work collaboratively with the women that I was speaking to, because it's like their stories, and it's such a vulnerable thing that I kind of broke my rule a little bit with that I wanted to just go over my wording of everything to make sure that they were 100% comfortable, because I knew how terrified I was. Like the night before it all came out, I did not sleep. I was like, have I made a mistake? I've never really injected myself in a story before. And I actually hadn't spoken to many friends or family about my medical situation. And so I hadn't really spoken to them about it. And I just started putting it out into the public. Everyone look at my most vulnerable moments. And but it's quite weird now, because people just know about it and just bring it up in conversation, because they're like, oh yeah, you're endo. And I'm like, yeah. And it's actually kind of nice, because I felt a lot in working in media. Like there were times that I'd be out on shoots or recording and I'd have horrendous pain and I couldn't tell anyone, and I didn't want people to think that I was, it's wrong, like lazy, or that I was like couldn't do it, because I was in, you know, I just didn't want them to think that it was like me trying to not do work or me making excuses. So I usually just battled through it. So it was actually kind of nice going to work and being like, if I felt a bit crappy, not that I should be like, oh yeah, she's allowed to be rude to, no, I would not do that. I'm never rude to anyone. But, you know, like it was kind of nice that she, it felt like a weight lifted, that I was like, yeah, this is something that I'm struggling with. And I was just really overwhelmed with all the feedback I got from people, like hundreds and hundreds of messages from like colleagues as well. Colleagues I had no idea had endometriosis or other fertility issues. And just members of the public saying like, this really helped me. And yeah, it was just really overwhelming. And it was worth the anxiety, I think, that I was feeling, and the lack of sleep out of panic about sharing it with people.
Was it quite liberating in a sense? Because you now feel like it's all out in the open. I don't feel like I have to explain myself anymore. And on top of that as well, you're giving a voice to other people that traditionally have felt like they've had to explain themselves. I think there was like a really interesting quote where you talked about how there was nothing more disappointing than the fact that you went to the doctor's office and you had the doctor basically say to you, there's nothing wrong with you, like, go take an aspirin, basically, and go home. Mm-hmm. Like, do you feel like by you inserting yourself in that story, that you've added an extra layer to kind of validate how people have felt? Because did you have many people actually outside of maybe the journalistic circle as well as your family call you up or approach you about it? Like, did you get some interesting feedback from other people outside that kind of sphere?
I actually had a nursing student get in contact with me, and that meant a lot that she was going to share it with all of the her fellow students in the class, which meant a lot to me because I feel like women really aren't listened to in the health space still. As soon as it's womb problems, I don't care. Like, I remember going, I've got it in the series where I remember going to the hospital thinking my appendix was bursting, and it was actually just pain, but, you know, like, couldn't walk, in absolute agony. It was kind of like laughed off. And I just hope that it makes maybe some medical professionals think, actually, this is really serious and you should investigate more, or just encourage women to advocate for themselves. Not that they should have to do that, but know that they can feel confident in saying, actually, no, this is very common. And I want more tests to be done, because I know someone who fought to get surgery and they didn't have it, but then they ended up having a cyst on their ovary. So it was like another issue. And obviously there's clearly something wrong if you're in agony. So regardless of if it's endometriosis or something else, like, I want people to feel empowered to actually advocate for themselves and not be fobbed off, basically, which I understand doctors are really under a lot of pressure. Yeah, like, it's like the average time. I think it took me 13 years to be diagnosed. So if it means that someone doesn't have to wait that long, that would be good.
There's something interesting you also brought up about the fact that you're saying, oh, I felt ridiculous, like, being emotional about the fact I'm 29 and I'm being told I have to have kids now. But in the same respect, I'm interested to kind of dive into that a little bit more, because the industry is quite stressful in the sense of, like, if you're going to try and have children, sometimes in your early 30s is not the best time for a lot of us. It's kind of, we're coming up, like you said, we're coming up into our careers, or maybe coming into more senior roles in our 30s. Do you feel like that in itself was maybe more, like, obviously there might be some point that you might want children, but do you feel like that was a more concerning thing, that you might have to just completely put your career on hold because of this whole situation? Like, I'd love to know a little bit more about your thoughts there. Like, did you feel like by you taking a break or you having a child, that would be career done?
Yeah, definitely. It was something that played on my mind a lot. And, you know, there are people that do it. Like, there are people that have kids and they have a thriving career. But it was a really big fear for me that I was just sort of getting comfortable in my career. And I'm like that now, where I feel like it would be really detrimental to my career. And I don't know many people who work in the media part-time either. Like, it's a very demanding job, a lot of long hours. And, you know, like, my partner works in the media as well, and so we both work very demanding hours. So I don't know how a child's going to fit into that. And I feel like my career would be really impacted. I've seen women who want to work part-time and then they get looked over for promotions and things because they are only working part-time. But then I've seen people succeed as well, and it's kind of like, which one am I going to be? And that does really play on your mind. And I just feel like media is really demanding, that if throwing a kid into the mix could really detriment your career, your progression. And but it shouldn't be like that, I'd just like to say. And people do it. But I have seen, you know, I think it's come a long way in the media, but I have seen women who have suffered because of having kids. And I've also seen, I don't know, as a woman, I only feel like now in my 30s, in some cases, that I'm being taken seriously. Not by everyone. This is by a few people. Like, I've had, for example, that I went for this role and I didn't get it and it was fine. But then a guy got the role who was the same age as me, and the person turned around and said, oh, but you're so young. And I was like, I'm the same age as the guy who got that role. So, you know, just little things like that. Or I've had, like, someone doesn't like my reporting, they call me a cub reporter and things like that. And it's like, I've been in this, I got that once, and I'd been in the role for like I've been in journalism for 8 years at this point. So I was like, okay, are you saying that because I look like a young female, and so your retaliation is to call me like a cub reporter? Or just people commenting on your appearance and things. And I had someone say to me that I'd be better behind the behind the camera instead of in front of it, which I feel like is maybe I wouldn't have got if I was a guy. I don't know, but yeah, it's the exception. Like most of the time it's okay, but there is sometimes this gendered stuff that comes in that you kind of think, is this to do with me being a woman? Yeah.
I'm curious about this because you've moved through exactly. It's not like you're a junior reporter. It's not like you're a junior journalist. You've been doing this for a number of years, and I'm also interested to see, is that kind of what took you to make the decision to move out in New Zealand? I know there's probably various other reasons because, and I'm sure maybe you can comment as well, what kind of brought about the decision to move to the UK? I myself can see from talking to other people that maybe New Zealand media has been having a bit of a massive hit, especially in the news cycle. I'm aware of obviously News Hub was shutting down and a lot of places are losing funding. Was there also a sense of you felt like you had to move to the UK to be taken seriously as a journalist? Do you feel like you can't be in senior until you make that jump? Well, yeah, what kind of kicked off your move to the UK?
It's kind of weird because I was actually looking at going to the UK in 2020, at the end of 2020. So I don't really need to spell out why that didn't happen. And it's actually weird because it's so messed up because I'd actually had my dream job in New Zealand. Like, I loved my job. I had a great supervisor. I had a great team of people. I actually really loved it. And that's what made it really hard about going, because I was like, finally, I have this job that I really love, presenting the world news. And I felt like I was taken seriously. I felt like I was like really respected in that role. I feel like, I had an awesome, awesome manager. And so then I'm like, but there's always like this part of me that always wanted to try and make it work in London. And then a big thing in my series was like, I always wanted to go overseas and I've never done that. And I feel like I won't be able to do that for, it's going to be a lot harder with a child. Like, it's not impossible, but a lot harder. And so it was kind of like, well, if we don't go now, we're probably never going to do it. So we were both probably in the most stable jobs in media. And we're like, are we actually insane right now? This is so, so dumb. So dumb, but we really, it was just something that like we've always wanted to do. And so, yeah, it was now or never. We're like, we'll see if we can make it work. And the worst comes to worst, we'll go back to New Zealand. And I hope that RNZ would take me back because I loved working there. So, you know, it's, I'd rather that and fail over here than go back and never have tried. I just know it would always be something in the back of my mind that I'll feel like a little thing in the back of my head that I didn't ever do it. So that's kind of why we've done it. Terrible timing, actually, because we were both quite happy in our roles. But it was more age. It was our age, just my age and my medical situation. We were like, this is our kind of last chance to do it. Yeah.
I think that's a good reason to go, because that was definitely the same, but I took the total opposite end approach of what you did. I did it as early as possible because I was like, I'd rather take the risk now, and if it goes completely tits up, then I've still got another couple of years to kind of work out what I'm going to do next. But you guys, like, yeah, it's interesting you took the separate approach of like, we're happy, we're like having our best lives in New Zealand, but we're going to like pick up sticks and move over. And I think what...
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Is maybe the most noticeable thing for you moving from the New Zealand media industry to the UK, because it's a hell of a lot different. I noticed it instantly. Mm. What would you say has been the most noticeable difference for you moving into media in the UK in particular?
Yeah, well, I actually got really lucky. Like, I'm kind of it's actually stupid how lucky I got that I managed to get a role within 4 weeks of moving here while Trevor and for people who can't see, I can see your expression right now. Like, I always feel so bad telling people because I've heard horror stories and like my partner's found it really hard because they just don't, I don't know, they want UK experience for everything. But I'm lucky I got hired by someone who was also an immigrant who came to the UK. So they kind of understood how difficult it was. And so I was really lucky in that space. But it is, it's so different, the media space here. Just the competitiveness, like it's super competitive in New Zealand, but it's quite small. Whereas here it's just this huge thing. And it's there's a lot of nepotism. Not with everyone, but I just know a lot of people who are like, they know someone or like my partner went on a shoot and they're like, so who do you know? Because that's kind of like, it was like the assumption that they know someone, which I never, like you'd have people who had like family members in media and like my husband does, and but I never felt like that got me a job. Whereas I feel like there's a little bit of that here and just like these amazing people, like in my newsroom, there's people who talk like, they speak multiple languages and they went to these really like amazing universities and I'm like, oh my gosh, like what am I doing here? But yeah, it's just way bigger, way more competitive, weird hiring process, like hearing about jobs like 3 months after you've applied for them, there's a lot more contract work. Whereas I never worked on a con. I know a lot of people do in media in New Zealand as well, but I've always been pretty lucky that I didn't have to do contract work. So it's a big shift, and you kind of go from, I wasn't a big fish in a small pond, but I was like a medium fish in like a large, well, in a, you know, like a medium fish in a large pond. I felt like I'd established myself, whereas I feel a lot more like a minnow in an ocean here. But that's kind of why I did it, right? Like, have a go going in the ocean for a little bit and see if I can make it. So yeah, it's a real shift, and I recommend people interested to do it for sure, but it's tough out there.
It's a pivot, kind of in a way, proving to yourself as well that you can do it. I certainly know for myself when I finally got that first role and ready, and much like what you said, I went through application processes that took, I remember the one that I finally got, it took me 6 months to actually get the first role to jump through the door and finally get in there. Do you feel like you're having that feeling of like, I finally got to this point, like I can do this, like it's not out of the question? Because I remember the first day that I appeared, I was like, holy shit, these guys have gone to Oxford and all that sort of carry on. I went to broadcasting
Oxford
school
and Cambridge.
Went to,
yeah.
yeah, that's what I mean. I'm like, why the hell am I in this room? Like, Jesus, what? You speak German and French? Like, I went on holiday to like Akaroa. Like, what is this? Like, how are we in the same room? Like, do you feel like that's kind of like a big part of you making the UK thing of being like, I know I can do this and I know there's still further for me to go?
Yeah, I think it's pushed me. I felt like I was in a kind of comfortable space. And so it's not like, it's kind of like a, not a knock on your confidence, but you kind of have to really like hype yourself up more. And I suffer from imposter syndrome so much where I'm just like, what am I doing? I think I have, I think my partner gets sick of me talking about it where I'm just like, I don't know, like, am I good enough to do this? Or can I, like, just really pathetic stuff that regularly happens just because people are so talented and you constantly have to feel like you have to learn new stuff all the time. Because I remember broadcasting school, we did shorthand for 2 hours a day, which is ridiculous now because we have transcribing, I hate to think how many hours I spent learning shorthand, T-line shorthand. Now it's just a party trick and I never use it because I am transcribing. But that's like in such a short amount of time and it's so much more digital and it's video. And so even working in radio and podcasting, I've had to do a video and I've had to do, you know, like long digital copy, and it's all just part of it where they want you to do everything. And moving to the UK, I feel like it's even more so. Like some of the jobs here, they want you to do like 6 different jobs. And so I really feel like we're seeing it a lot in New Zealand at the moment, but I really feel like it's like happening here in London that you have to have so many roles. And there's so many like new people coming through into the industry who can do all that. So there's no like resting on your laurels being like, oh yeah, I've got some experience. It's like, no, you got to keep learning these skills. Otherwise you're going to be out of a job or you're going to be obsolete basically. So yeah, it's been an adjustment for sure.
I can completely understand that. I think that was the thing that scared me when I was seeing like new students coming through, because I think the one advantage. Yeah, that's what I mean. There's so much talent and it's like, damn, can you guys stop? I want to still have a job in like 5 years. And it's like, I remember specifically the main reason I ended up getting my first radio role was I was the only one that knew the scheduling software, which for anyone that does radio, I was the only one that knew it. Could also do the producing and could also do like social media. But now everyone can do everything. Everyone can do the socials. Everyone can do this. Everyone can do that. And you're totally right. There is a lot more pressure on new broadcasters to do it because, as you said, it's a very trendy industry. For everyone wants to do it because it is fun. Even though it's demanding, it's very fun. And I think one of the other things I'd love to kind of understand as well is you've made the pivot as well in the sense of you've done the radio thing, you've done video, now you're into podcasting, you're working for CNN. What do you think is, because you're working for the Five Things You Should Know podcast, what would you say are the five things that you feel have impacted your career the most, especially throughout your journey? Because I would love to know that.
It's going to sound very cheesy, but people, I think that's this career, you speak to so many different people from so many walks of life. And I feel like it's really impacted not just my career, but my whole life, because you kind of see different ways of thinking about things or the people. Like, I've met so many incredible people and you get to meet so many people who, I don't know, like, when I worked at Parliament, you're interviewing Prime Minister, you know, like, it's where else are you going to have a job like that where you interview a Prime Minister one day and then, I don't know, you're a pop star or a movie star, but then it's like every day people doing amazing things as well, or people going through really trying times and they're advocating for change. And I'm like, how do you find time to do all this? Just really inspiring people. I think that's a big thing. This is really tricky actually. I think maybe another thing would be just, I think it would be, this is actually really hard. God, this is a hard question. I think a big thing as well is just how you present yourself, I think is a big thing. Like working in media, you kind of have to have a confidence, or at least portray a confidence, or you got to present yourself in ways to get the information you want. And I feel like that's really helped me in other walks of life. Probably makes me like a whinger, maybe a bit of a Karen if I feel like a bit of injustice. But, you know, like saying if, like, I don't know, like something went wrong with my flat and they weren't fixing it, I'll like look up all the laws and I know what it is. And, you know, like, I feel like you kind of, and I remember being taught this at broadcasting school, you learn how councils work, you learn how laws work, you know, you kind of have to be like a jack of all trades. So I think that's one, is like how to get, not get things what you want, but you know how to advocate for yourself.
So property managers hate you then.
Yeah,
property. You're like, that mark was there before I moved in. Like, I'm not losing my bond over this.
Yeah. I did a story on the healthy home standard. So actually I know, you know, yeah. So I guess maybe it's just being plugged in with stuff, because you can't really, I try going on holidays and then something big will happen and you're behind. Like, I remember going on holiday when the Hamas attack happened. It actually happened on my 30th birthday. So even though it was my birthday, I still need to check the news and check what's happening, because you just constantly have to be plugged in. But it's actually really, it's useful, because there's stuff to talk people about and you're informed, which I know like a lot of people want to switch off at the moment just because the news is so bloody depressing. But, you know, oh my gosh, sound like an after-school special, but, you know, knowledge is power and all that. So, you know, you should be plugged in, and I feel like this job kind of makes you do that. What else? Time management, which any of my friends are going to laugh about this because I'm late all the time, no matter how hard I try. They tell me that it's 15 minutes earlier than it actually is, because I really struggle with that. But deadlines at work, that's serious. And you know, like I know how to lock in. I feel like that's a big thing. And I think, yeah, it kind of goes back to the people, but like empathy as well. I think empathy is really important as a journalist. I think it makes you more thoughtful. I remember someone at Parliament told me that, because, you know, you're not biased or anything, but like no one's here to purposely make the country worse. They all have like, they have different ways of doing it, but no one's actively here trying to make the country worse. They think this is the best for the country. And so I kind of take that through into a lot of reporting, as that sometimes, you know, I feel like, especially at the moment, everything's very partisan, and just trying to be mindful of that, because you have to be balanced in your reporting. And I think it's something I try and take on board in my day-to-day life, even if I disagree with people about things, is that not losing my empathy and being respectful of people as best as I can. And also just in reporting, like some people, like when I was working as a St. John call handler, they told me you're speaking to people on the worst day of their life. And that happens in journalism too. So yeah, I think that's a big thing as well, is just being mindful of your platform and not to let your own judgments or preconceptions overall, if that makes sense. Sorry, that's a very, that's very long-winded, but I guess that's kind of my, yeah, just be empathetic to people and try not to be biased, and yeah, and I try and carry that on in other aspects of my life as well.
Yeah, because that's what I'm curious about as well, because I feel as a journalist, yeah, you do have to have this point of being non-judgmental, being able to kind of see things from both sides. And I feel like that must be, yeah, as you said, hard at times, because I'm sure you're going to have your own view of whatever's going on in the world, especially with, as you said, there's so many horrible things happening in the world. I won't dip into anything, so I definitely don't want to have any pretty racy opinions on either end of the scale, yeah, to be fair. But like, do you feel like that has made you more empathetic and more open to kind of hearing out people that maybe you wouldn't usually speak to? Or does it make you more open to speak with people that you wouldn't usually speak to because you try to see it from their perspective, or even more so understand their story? Do you feel like as a journalist that's kind of like a skill you've developed for your own like personal life?
Yeah, I think I used to be very opinionated, and I've learned to, it's actually better for everyone all around. If you know, you can have like a healthy discussion, but there's no need for things to get nasty, or there's no need for, yeah, I think it has. I think it's helped me be more level-headed. Maybe discussing politics with my family at Christmas, you know, that might get, no one's perfect, but when you're like, actually, that's not right. I know that's not right, because it's more factual thing than my opinion. That's factually incorrect. But yeah, I do think it's helped me get along more with people that I might not usually. And I think that's more beneficial, because then you're actually having like a proper conversation rather than it becoming you butting heads, and that actually doesn't serve anyone. Just provide information, not be nasty. And yeah, I know it's hard sometimes when people say something particularly incorrect, but there's a nice way of going about it. And yeah, I don't know. It's just, yeah, I think it's maybe more patient. I think it's maybe more patience. I'm trying to be careful here.
No, I totally understand. And there's one more question we're going to do that's completely off track, kind of what we've been talking about. But what would you say has been your favorite moment in relation to your mum and your career? Because I'm sure your mum or your parents or your family would have been listening in to you, probably doing a story or talking about something significant. Is there any standout moment for you as well, of like maybe your parents or your family kind of reaching out, being like, Charlie, I just heard you on the radio doing this. Like, it's fantastic. Like, or them like chiming in on something. What do you think has been the most memorable moment where your parents have kind of like been like, Charlie, you know what? That was great. Like, is there any particular moment you can think of?
I think speaking to my mum about the endometriosis, because she has endometriosis as well. So I spoke to her as part of the project. And it was kind of nice having her included in that, because she's not really someone who listens to the news, which is, yeah, surprising. Like, neither of my parents really plug into the news, but they try and make an effort for me. I'm like, you should listen to this one. Or if I've got a big project, they'll listen to it. I think especially my in-laws listen as well to everything I do. They were avid RNZ, well, they still are avid RNZ listeners. So it's always been really cool getting their support. And actually my father-in-law used to work on the rural news at RNZ. So we kind of have like this cool bonding experience. I think that's been really cool. But I think a big thing is just, with family, even though they're not really, my parents aren't really into the media, they make like an effort to be interested, I think is been really cool. But my in-laws though are very plugged in and they listen a lot, which is really lovely.
Oh, I love that. It's so perfect.
It's so sweet. Yeah, of them.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. I think that's like quite special. And like you said, the moment that you got to share with your mum where you kind of had this kind of heart tug. So I remember even seeing in the discussion that you're like, you kind of learned more about her through doing that story. Like there were things that she obviously never would have mentioned to you otherwise. Do you also feel like being a journalist in a sense is giving you the ability to kind of learn more about your family and your background, or maybe even your mum, for example, because like, you're more inquisitive? Do you feel like that's a part of being a journalist, being inquisitive and being curious?
Yeah, definitely. I try and ask more questions for sure. And I really love hearing people's backstories because two of my grandparents died, it was a few years ago now, but before they passed, I really made sure to make an effort to like ask them a lot about their history. And I find myself though, and I hear other journalists do it because I have chats with other journalists and they start talking to me and I realize that they're interviewing me. So it's something I actively try not to do because I notice when they're doing, they're like, so tell me about that. And you're just like, you got into interview mode now. Can we just have a chat? So I try not to do that, but I think it definitely, makes me, ask a lot more questions and want to know about people's backgrounds. And even when it's like, I don't know, if something medically is going on, I'm like, okay, I kind of go into like journo mode where I'm like, okay, I've got to know the facts and I've got to know this. And like, even if something's stressful, I'm like, okay, I just like cram myself with information. So I feel like I do that to people as well, but try not to interview them because I've seen other journalists do it to me and I can tell when they're doing it. So I'm very, very aware of it.
So glad you mentioned this because I've been told the exact same thing by my friends as well. And I'm not even a journalist. The radio thing where they're like, are you going to put this somewhere? Like, are you working for the feds? Like, what the hell, man? Like, yeah, stop. Like, and I'm like, oh shit, sorry, my bad. Like, do you think in a way as well, that's kind of made you have like stronger relationships because you kind of like know the whole story of people? Like you're getting more in depth. So people kind of say like, oh, Charlie, like you really listen to what's going on.
I think so. And I think as well, it's just, I think it, like a big thing I really prided myself on was being able to get people to open up in interviews. So I hope that friends and family feel like they can do that with me because, I don't know, I just try and make myself approachable, make myself listen. And like, what's that meme at the moment where it's like, we listen and we don't judge. And I kind of try and take that on with listening to friends and stuff and not to, I don't know, take things at face value. Or my only thing is I'm probably a bit too, like, I look for like little micro gestures in people. Like I'm trying to find out their true intentions, you know, like a politician trying to dodge a question. And sometimes I like try and weasel information out. And I'm like, no, I'm not in like, you know, like I'm like, if they want to tell me that, that's cool, but like I shouldn't be pushing. And I realize sometimes I'm doing it, but oh, what do you mean? Like I see them skirt around a detail. I'm like, oh, no, I noticed you skirted around that. I'm going to ask you about that. And that's probably the bad side of it is that if I feel like someone's kind of keeping something, I'm just super nosy and try and find out, which is terrible. And I when I catch myself doing it, I try to stop.
No, you're very much justifying my feelings on a lot of things. My girlfriend has said I do a very similar thing. She was like, you do this thing where I can totally tell you, like, throw, like, what do you call it? Like a, there's a term for it. Like a red sparrow kind of thing. Like, you throw in a false line to see if they bite, and then you're like, oh, yeah, that's the information I wanted. And it's like, I'm so terrible at it because I don't realize I'm doing it half the time. And she's like, Jamie, I feel like you're looking for something. Like, you're always, yeah, so that's cool. I feel justified now. Thank you, Charlie.
Yes.
Okay, I feel like a less horrible human. Other people
it's
do it as well.
Industry problem.
Okay. Yeah, it is an industry problem. Yeah, this is the thing they should really talk about.
Yeah.
But I love that. And it's also interesting, and this will, I promise this will be the final question because I don't want to take up too much more of your time, mate. But do you think being in a relationship with someone that is in the industry with you has made it easier for you to be able to handle some of the bad days or maybe some of the stressful moments that you've gone through?
Yeah, 100%. I don't think I'd still be in the media if it wasn't for Angus, my husband, because there is really trying times in the media where you do really long days. And I know it can be like trying for a lot of relationships if you're not home a lot, whereas he has always been really good about it. And vice versa, like when he's away, like he used to work every weekend on this show because it would like go live to air on a Sunday. And it was tough. And, you know, you don't get to spend time with each other as much as you want. Probably shouldn't. I'll share this anyway. So when I worked in Auckland, the hours were horrific and I had no social life because I was working all the evenings. So you couldn't go out with friends, you couldn't have hobbies or anything, or it was really difficult to. And then Angus was working like 80 hours a week and we were just like hating life. And we were poor, like junior producer on an internship. And he'd come pick me up because we lived in quite a rough part of town at midnight, bless him, after working like 12 to 14 hour days. Go home, we'd make a G&T and we'd smoke a cigarette on our balcony. And that was our bonding experience. I don't smoke anymore, but that's what we used to do just to get us through. So we've kind of had this shared trauma. Sometimes we're like, financially, it'd probably be better if one of us had like, it was a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer or something. But I think it's been really good that we've worked together. And we even worked together at RNZ for years and have lunch together and stuff. So I don't know. And I've worked with Angus and we actually work together really well, which surprises me. But he's definitely, we've been like a support to each other through, yeah, which is can be it's such rewarding industry, but it's like hard work as well, and you need someone who can appreciate that and not add to your stress by being like, why are you working these long hours and stuff. So it's been really, yeah, it's been really good.
I think that's the best
so
place
sappy.
To leave it as
you,
as you bashing G&Ts and smoking a cig before you go back to work, like absolutely perfect, mate. Well, thank you so much, Charlie, for like sharing obviously some of the war stories from you working in New Zealand and now your current career in the UK, and also kind of just delving into a little bit more of like the mind of a journalist. And yeah, I just can't thank you enough for being so open and honest. Like I think it's a rarity, especially in this day and age. And you've been a fantastic resource probably for a lot of people that are going to be thinking like, hell yeah, I should give this a home. But yeah, so thank you so much, mate.
No, thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.